"So why didn't we just protect ourselves?" Kate asked. "Hell, what does it take to build a better surge protector?"
John sighed and shook his head. She was so damn right. "Kate, it's some rather technical stuff, but it meant retrofitting a lot of stuff, hundreds of billions, perhaps, to do all of it. And besides, a lot of people in high places, well, they just glazed over when the scientists started with the technical jargon. The reports would go into committees and..."
"And now we got this," Charlie said coldly.
John nodded, frustrated.
"Global warming, sure. Spend hundreds of billions on what might have been a threat, though a lot say it wasn't. This, though, it didn't have the hype, no big stars or politicians running around shouting about it, and it just never registered on anyone's screen except for a few."
"I don't get it with the cars, though," Tom interjected. "Computers, yes, but a car?"
"Any car, made after roughly 1980 or so, has some solid-state electronics in it," John said. "Remember carburetors? Thing of the past, with fuel injection and electronic ignition. That's why my mother-in-law's old Edsel is okay and Bartlett's VW out there. No computers in the engine, and vacuum tubes in the radio. The surge had nothing to fry off. Therefore, it still runs. Now everything in a car is wired into some kind of computer. Better living through modern science."
John fished in his pocket for a cigarette, pulled it out, then hesitated. Kate was glaring at him, as was Tom. The town had a no-smoking ordinance for all its buildings. John hesitated, but damn, he wanted one now.
"Look, guys, if you want me to talk, I get a cigarette."
"Mary would kick your ass if she knew you were still smoking," Kate said.
"Don't lay the guilt on me," John replied sharply.
It was Mary's dying that had snagged him back into smoking after being clean for 10 years. The army had started getting uptight on it, and amongst all the other aspects of grooming for the star, smoking was a checkmark against him with some of the bean counters and actuaries in the Pentagon, who argued why invest the effort on a guy who might die early.
"Go on, light up,"
she hesitated.
"And give me one of those damn things, too."
Now it was his turn to hesitate. He hated leading someone back into sin, but on this day, what the hell? He lit her cigarette. She leaned back in her chair, inhaled deeply, let it out, and sighed.
"God damn, I've been wanting that for 6 years now. Damn, is it good."
A couple of seconds later, she actually smiled, the first time she had done so since he walked in.
"Head rush," she muttered,
then took another puff.
"Damn near everything has a computer in it now," John continued. "Cash registers, phones, toys, cars, trucks, but most vulnerable of all, the complex web of our electrical distribution system. All of it was waiting to get hit."
Tom leaned against the wall and let a few choice words slip out.
"You think they'd have seen this coming, done something about it?"
"Who is they, Tom?"
"Jesus, John, you know. The President, Homeland Security. Hell, I was getting emails damn near every day on terrorist alerts, training on what to do if they hijacked a truck loaded with nuclear waste, even a drill with the hospital last year if they unleashed some sort of plague. I got 20 bio and hazmat suits in a storage closet. Never even heard about this thing being talked about."
John sighed.
"Yeah, I know. It was off most people's screens. Seemed too sci-fi to some of them. But that doesn't matter now."
"I'm still worried about radiation, though," Kate said. "Fallout?"
"Don't.
You sound rather assured of yourself."
"You don't have a single radio working here. Nothing at all?" John asked.
Tom shook his head.
"I do." "Where?"
"In the Edsel. It's an old tube radio. I checked it out last night. Static from one end to the other. If this thing was local, if they had popped a bomb over Atlanta, Charlotte, we'd still be picking up radio stations from the Midwest and Northeast."
"Why?"
"It's a horizon event. Line of sight, like I said.
I'll guess it was 1 to 3 nukes, lit off a couple of 100 miles up above the atmosphere, covered most, maybe all, of the United States. Fallout is a byproduct of rubble blown up into the atmosphere from a bomb going off. Pop an EMP above the atmosphere, and, well, at least you don't have any fallout worries.
Jesus Christ, Charlie sighed.
That caught John slightly off guard. Charlie was strict Southern Baptist, and for him to say that, well, it was a major sin, though a Catholic wouldn't think twice about it.
Who do you think did it?
Does it matter? John replied.
Yeah, maybe it does to me, Tom said. I got a boy over in Iraq right now. You know that one of my nephews is with the Navy out in the Pacific? I sure as hell would like to know who they're fighting. If it was the Chinks, my nephew will be in it. The Ragheads, and it's my son.
Doubt if it's China, John said quietly.
Why? You said they were the ones doing the research.
Doing the research, but using it in a first strike? Doubt it. They are just as vulnerable to EMP as we are. Do it to us, and we'd flatten them, and they know it.
Will you have it, too?
Sure we do. What the hell do you think the threat was to Saddam back in 1991? Charlie, you were over there then, same as me, you remember.
Yeah. If they hit us with any weapon of mass destruction, the word was we'd pop a nuke off about 20 miles above Baghdad.
When a nuke goes off above the atmosphere, or even in the high upper atmosphere, it sets off that electrical chain reaction I talked about. Again, just like a solar flare. Usually the upper atmosphere absorbs the magnetic disturbance of a solar flare, and up north we see that as the northern lights. But if it's big enough, the disturbance hits the ground and starts shorting things out. So we threatened Saddam with an EMP if he unleashed anything on us, John said. It would have shut down the entire power grid of central Iraq, and shut down their entire command and control system as well. They didn't, so we didn't.
Wouldn't that have fried our stuff, too? Kate asked.
No. Remember, it's line of sight. 20 miles up, our forces in Saudi Arabia would have been below the horizon. Besides, all our equipment was hardened against EMP to varying degrees. They spent a lot of money on that back during the Reagan years.
So our military is still okay here in the States, then?
Kate asked. Doubt it. That's the gist of the report I just gave you. Every administration since Reagan's has placed hardening of our electronics on the back shelf. Meanwhile, the equipment kept getting more delicate and thus susceptible, and the potential power of the burst kept getting one hell of a lot stronger. Remember how we were all wowed by the high-tech stuff back in 1991? That equipment is now as primitive as a steam engine compared to what we got now. And in constantly making computers and electronics faster and better, we made them smaller, more compact, and more vulnerable to an EMP strike. He dropped the butt of his cigarette into his nearly empty coffee cup, offered a second to Kate, who took it, and lit another for himself.
Who then?
For my money, maybe North Korea. Maybe Middle East terrorists with some equipment supplied by Iran, Korea, or both. As for the warhead, we all know there's enough of those left over from the old Soviet Union that sooner or later someone would get their hands on, if for nothing else than the goodies inside that go bang. Iran and Korea were hell-bent on making nukes as well. But they'd be crazy to throw 3 or 4 at us when we could make the rubble glow for 100 years with 1,000 fired back in reply. But turn them into EMP weapons, and they win. At least in terms of hitting us harder than we could ever have dreamed of. Maybe launched from a sub. Hell, even from a freighter that got up a couple of 100 miles from the coast. Get that close and even an old scud could just about get the package high enough. One, like I said, maybe 2 or 3, and you've just castrated the entire country.
We'll flatten the bastards for this, Tom snapped.
Most likely already have. But do they give a shit? Hell no. The leaders will survive. They're most likely down in bunkers 1,000 feet deep laughing their asses off right now.
Hell, if we flatten them, they'll tell their own people that survive that we struck first, and then they got millions more followers.
I can't yet believe this, Kate sighed.
Sun Tzu, Charlie said. John looked at him and smiled. The enemy will never attack you where you are strongest. He will attack where you are weakest. If you do not know your weakest point, be certain your enemy will.
All three looked at him in surprise.
Hey, I remember a few things from college.
No one spoke for a moment.
What happened out there? John said softly. Doesn't matter to us now. It's what happens here in Black Mountain that does.
How long before the power comes back on? Kate asked. Or we get some word from Washington on what to do, or even from Raleigh or Asheville?
Strangely, an old Civil War song flashed into his mind, a line from Lorena. It may be for years, and it may be forever.
Weeks, months, maybe years, John said,
and he found he could not look into Kate's eyes as he said it. Yesterday, her biggest concern was the hot argument in the town about who would be Grand Marshal this year for the 4th of July parade, that and the continuing wrangle with Asheville about water rates.
We've got to prioritize, Tom said. Security, for one thing. I've got 500 strangers from the interstate on my hands this morning. What the hell should we do with them, for starters?
No one spoke.
Well, we just can't kick them out, Kate said.
John did not reply.
Priorities for getting through this, Charlie interjected.
And now everyone was becoming agitated. John realized that for the last 15 hours they had been waiting for someone else to tell them what to do. The reality was beginning to hit, that there just might no longer be someone else.
Water first, Kate said. Once the tank on top of the hill runs dry, the pipes will start emptying out. We don't have any means, then, of pumping more back up to the tank. Most of the town will be dry within a day.
We're lucky in one sense, Charlie said. We get our water gravity-fed from the reservoir. The dam face is at 2,500 feet above sea level, so at least here in town we'll get some. But anyone above that elevation line is screwed.
John realized that meant him. His neighbor had a sign on his driveway, half-mile high. They were 250 feet above the gravity feed point for water.
At least we have the pool, thank God.
Food, Tom said. Jesus, no electric means no refrigeration.
John was silent, on his third cigarette, as the other three argued about what to do next.
I'm making a quick run up to the college, and once the pharmacy opens, I've got a very important errand to run, John said. I've told you all I know, so if you will excuse me.
He stood up and started for the door.
John!
He knew this was coming. It was Tom.
Concerning your car?
What about my car?
I'd like to have it.
Why?
I need to get around.
Use a bike. It'll be good for you.
John, don't bullshit around with me. I need that car. I'll give you a lift home, but I do need it.
John stared right at Kate for a moment, then back at Tom.
That car is mine, my family's. You declaring martial law?
I think we'll have to,
Kate said quietly.
When you do, come and try and take it, Tom. What do you mean, try?
Just that.
Just try.
Tom stood silent, no one speaking, and then finally he nodded.
Okay, John.
He looked back at Kate, who sighed and then nodded in agreement.
Sorry, John. We were out of line.
That's okay. Just a bit of advice, Kate.
And that is?
He pointed to the cigarette in her hand.
Now that you are hooked again, you better go over to Smiley's and get several cartons, cash only. If Hamid says he doesn't have cartons, pull rank on him. He's hiding them in the back of the store. You better load up now, 'cause you're going to need them.
John turned and headed out the door and then realized that Tom had followed him out.
"What the hell is it now?" John asked. Tom hesitated.
"Look, John, sorry. I haven't slept since yesterday. Sorry about back in there."
And he extended his hand. John took it. "Tom, I don't envy you your job one bit."
"Look, John, I know I might not be the brightest light bulb in the pack. You're the smart guy. I like my job, though, and try to do what's right. But I never thought I'd be dealing with something like this."
"Yeah, I know. Hard day."
"Damn. I hope I'm wrong about everything I just said back in there. My first thought was it was some sort of weird solar storm. Maybe I'm dead wrong, and 10 minutes from now the lights will come back on."
"Think they will?" Tom asked hopefully. John reluctantly shook his head, went over to his car, unlocked it, and got in. He almost felt guilty as he turned the switch and the car roared to life. Everyone gathered in the parking lot, looked at him as he drove off. The run-up to the college had been a quick one. He felt, though, that he had to go, just check on what was happening. A lot of heads turned as he drove into the campus and pulled in front of Gaither Hall.
"Hey, Doc, cool wheels!"
someone shouted, and John nodded and smiled. The conversation with President Hunt only took a couple of minutes. He had basically figured out the same thing, and was already organizing the place. The kids were feasting on steak and ice cream this morning. They were emptying out the freezers as quick as possible and stuffing the food into bellies. Anything preserved or canned could wait. The kids on this small campus were a good crew, and ready to help out. A group had been organized to push cars clear of the road. Others were hauling buckets of water all the way from the lake up to makeshift tanks near buildings, in case of fire. The water in the campus pool would serve as drinking water, and 4 porta-potties, hauled with much groaning and complaining, had been commandeered from the construction site for the new gym and a couple of new houses going up in the cove, and placed in front of the dorms. The head of campus security, Washington Parker, who until now was viewed by most of the kids as a rent-a-cop, to be teased about falling asleep in the student union at 3 in the morning, now had a job. He was old ex-military, an actual Marine sergeant from long ago, in his early 60s, and the good-natured guy who usually had nothing more to do than bust a kid for being publicly drunk or shine a spotlight into a parked car to break up a hot and heavy session. Parker had already met with the heftier members of the ball team and their coach to discuss keeping the campus safe and setting up a 24-hour watch. Parker had taken his job seriously for years, in spite of the fact that if ever there was a safe campus in the mountains of western North Carolina, it was Montreat College, up in the cove. A year or two would go by without even a minor crime, let alone the far more serious issues of rape, assault, or heavy drugs. But he had religiously attended every conference on campus security offered by the government, especially the ones that dealt with the potentials of a terrorist takeover of a campus. He had once talked with John about that issue, pointing out that the fact that they were, in general, so darn safe up in these mountains meant they were exactly the type of campus that just indeed might be hit. As John pulled away from Gaither Hall and turned to head back into town, he spotted Washington standing by the gateway that led into the campus. John slowed and came to a stop. Washington looked over at him, and then actually saluted.
"Morning, Colonel."
It was an old joke between the two, Colonel and Sergeant, but today it felt more than a little strange.
"Inspecting the troops?" Washington asked. "Just figured I'd drive up and see how things were here." "It's EMP, isn't it?"
"How'd you know?"
"Your call, for one, sir," Washington drawled, his deep South Carolina African-American accent rich and full, mingled in with that clip tone of a former Marine drill sergeant. "Pre-solid-state electronics. I bet Miss Jan's Mustang'll run as well."
Her home was within walking distance of the campus. The realization caught him. Everything was measured in walking distance now.
You dropping a hint, Sergeant?
Yes, sir, I am. It'd be good to have at least one vehicle up here so I can move around quickly if needed. Besides, once people start figuring things out, it'll get stolen.
She'll kill me if I ever tell her, so it's between us, Washington.
John fished into his pocket and pulled out his key ring and snapped one off.
That's to her house. Security code number is...
He laughed softly and shook his head. The key to the Mustang, well, I never had security clearance for it.
Washington laughed. I can jump it.
It's yours for the duration, John hesitated. Or until this old beast breaks down or someone gets it. Chief Barker and I nearly got on that very issue less than an hour ago. I managed to hang on to this monster, but Barker just might remember the Mustang, so I suggest you get over there now. Possession is always 9/10 of the law.
Deal, sir. I'll take good care of her. No joyriding, sir.
Come on, Washington, it's John. Cut the sir shit. I work for a living now.
Washington smiled.
You said the duration, sir, when it came to the car.
And now his features were serious. Washington finally looked away from him and back to the gate.
Good position here, you know that,
Washington said. John had thought about it more than once on his drive up the cove to the campus. The gatehouse was a stone arch over the roadway, a tiny stone building with nearly sheer ledges to either side, the road having been cut through the ledge 100 years back. Long ago, back in the 1920s, it had been the entry to a tourist road that weaved up the mountains all the way to the top of Mount Mitchell. The gatehouse was a quaint leftover of that long-abandoned road. To the east of the gate, Flat Creek tumbled by. To the west, a near-vertical cliff cut through the descending ridge to open the lane for the road. There was only one way in and one way out, and it was here. Washington had obviously contemplated this fact long years ago. John said nothing, and he drove off, heading back into town, crossing State Street and over the tracks of the Norfolk and Southern. He passed the Holiday Inn. A number of people were sitting around outside. A group of kids were playing tag. Several grills were set up, food cooking on them. He slowed as he spotted someone standing down by the road, her arms folded, just gazing off towards the mountains. He pulled up, again a bit uncomfortable with how many people turned at the sight of his car. The woman looked at him. There was a flicker of recognition.
"Ma'am, I owe you an apology."
"I think you do."
She was still dressed in her business suit, but the high heels were gone, replaced with a battered pair of sneakers. He opened the door and got out and extended his hand.
"Look, seriously, I apologize. I had my kids with me, my mother-in-law, and frankly," he hesitated.
She relented and extended her hand and took his.
"Sure, I understand. Guess I'd have done the same if the roles were reversed."
"John Matheson."
"Michaela Turner."
"Curious name."
"My granddad was stationed in Hawaii during the war. Said it was a flower there. Talked my dad into using the name."
John couldn't help but let his eyes drift for a second. She was tall, even without her heels on, 5'10" or so, slender, blonde hair to shoulder length, top two buttons of her blouse unbuttoned. It was just the quickest of glances, but he knew she was watching.
Strange. If you don't check an attractive woman out even for a second, it's an insult. If you do, there might be a cold, icy stare.
She smiled slightly.
"Where are you from?" John asked.
"Charlotte. Supervising nurse for a cardiac surgical unit. Was coming up here to attend a conference at Memorial Mission Hospital on a new procedure for heart arrhythmias. Now, could you do me a favor and tell me just what the hell is going on?"
"That reminds me," John said. "Look, I've got to do something right now. Will you be here in 10 minutes?
"Sure."
He got back into the car, hesitated, and looked at her. "I'm heading to the drugstore right now. I need to get something. If you want, you can come along." She didn't move. "I'm not trying to pick you up or anything, really. I gotta get some medication for my daughter. Just, I can answer your questions while I drive."
"Okay. Don't seem to be going anywhere else."
It was only several more blocks to the shopping plaza with Ingram's Market and the CVS drugstore. The parking lot was nearly full, but no one was about. He got out and looked at the drugstore, disappointed. It was dark. Damn, it must be closed. But then he realized the absurdity of that. All the stores were dark. "I think it was EMP, like I just said," John said, continuing their brief conversation.
"Had the same thought."
"Why?"
She smiled. "I help run a surgical unit. We had a lot of disaster drills, especially since 9/11. We did a scenario on that one, EMP. It wasn't pleasant. Kept me awake thinking for nights afterwards. Hospitals aren't hardened to absorb it. The emergency backup generators will blow out along with everything else, and you know what that means."
"You'll have to tell me more later on," John said. He pulled on the door and it swung open. Inside was a minor bedlam. A harried clerk behind the counter shouting,
"Please, everyone, it is cash only. I'm sorry, no checks."
John walked past her to the back of the store and the pharmacist counter. One of the regulars was there, Rachel. Her daughter was one of Elizabeth's friends. One of a line of a dozen people, a heavy-set man in his early 40s, bit of a tacky suit, tie pulled down and half open, was at the counter.
"Listen to me," he shouted at Rachel. "I need that prescription filled now, God damn it!"
"And, sir, I keep trying to tell you I'm sorry, but we don't know you. We don't have a record for you on file, and that, sir, is a controlled substance."
"I'm from out of town, damn it. Don't you hicks up here understand that? Now listen, bitch, I want that prescription."
John caught the eye of Liz, the pharmacist. She was in her early 30s, and, John always thought, about the most attractive pharmacist he had ever laid eyes on. She was also married to an ex-ranger. Unfortunately, her husband was nowhere around, and with Liz at not much more than 5'2" and 100 pounds, she was definitely way out of her league. Liz looked at him appealingly. John took it in, looked around. A book and magazine rack by the counter. Nothing he could use. The cooler for beverages, however, was about 20 feet away. He backed over to it. Not many had hit here yet. Reached in and pulled out a liter bottle of Coors beer. Michaela was looking at him with disgust, not understanding what was happening. Liz, coming up to the counter, tried to confront the belligerent customer, extending her hand for him to calm down.
"Listen, damn it. Oxycontin, you hear me? I'll take 30, and you can call my doctor once the power comes back on, and he'll confirm it."
"Sir, please leave this store."
"That's it. Both of you bitches, get out of my way."
He started to climb over the counter, Liz backing up. John was up beside him and slashed out, the bottle smashing across the side of the man's head, shattering. As he started to collapse, John pulled him back from the counter, flinging him to the ground, and for good measure stomped him in the solar plexus, doubling him up. The man was on the floor, keening with a high, piercing shrill. Everyone else stood silent, stunned. John looked over at Liz.
"Sorry."
He actually felt embarrassed by what had just happened. He had broken a societal taboo. Folks around here did not go around smashing beer bottles across a guy's head from behind in the local pharmacy. John almost expected an alarm to go off, the police to come barging in. There was only silence, except for the pitiful cries of the man on the floor. Still silence. John looked at the others lined up. Several turned and fled. One woman was shaking her head.
"Is this how you treat strangers in this redneck town?" she snapped. "I'll be damned if I ever stop here again."
She stormed out. He recognized one of the men, Pat Burgess, a Baptist minister, part of his Civil War Roundtable Club. Pat nodded.
Good work, John.
Sorry, but with my heart, I'd most likely pitch the coronary if I had taken him on. It snapped John out of the momentary haze, the shock. Back to the reality of where they were and what had to be done, for that matter, what he was here to do.
Pat, can you see to him? Get a belt or something and tie his hands first. Maybe somebody can look at his face and see if I cut his eye.
You did, you goddamn bastard. I can't see. My lawyer's going to rip you an extra asshole.
The man started to scream again, and John tapped him with a shoe. He cringed, falling silent. John leaned over.
Listen to me. You threatened these women. One more word, and I will cut your eyes out, John said.
And the man fell back to crying, clutching his face, blood leaking out between his fingers. John looked back at Liz, then stepped around behind the counter.
Liz, can we talk for a moment?
Sure, John.
He motioned to the back corner of the pharmacy area, and the two went into the locked area and half-closed the door.
Thank God you came in, John, Liz whispered hoarsely. I've had three like that already. We bluffed the other two out, but that guy was crazy. Most likely addicted. Doesn't travel with any in case he ever gets stopped, and his supplies at home.
Look, Liz, I need a favor.
Liz fell silent, the look of gratitude disappearing.
I think we got a bad situation, Liz said quietly. Don't we?
I won't lie to you. I think we do.
She looked back towards the counter, the line of customers, more coming in and queuing up.
I've been here all night, she said wearily. I live in Asheville. Nothing was moving. I was hoping Jim might come to get me, but he hasn't shown.
Her voice trailed off.
How long before the electric comes back on?
I don't know.
How long?
A month. Maybe a year, or more.
My God, Liz sighed.
Exactly. And you know what I am asking for.
John, I have exactly 40 vials in stock. There's one other kid in this town with the same thing your girl's got. Over 100 adult diabetics with varying degrees of insulin needs. I've had 4 folks down here this morning already asking for extras. I can't give them out, John. I'm responsible to everyone here, not just Jen.
She hesitated.
Not just you, John.
Liz, we're talking about my daughter, my little girl.
And his voice began to choke. She pointed towards the neatly arrayed cabinets with medications.
John, I've got hundreds of people I'm responsible for, and if what you said is true, a lot of them will die, some in a matter of days. We just don't keep that much inventory in stock anymore. None of the pharmacies do. We rely on daily shipments.
There won't be daily shipments for quite a while, Liz.
Then my patients with pancreatic enzyme disorder, they don't take their pills daily, they die. If what you told me is true, Mrs. Sterling will be dead within a week.
Liz's voice trailed off, and she stifled back a sob. She took a deep breath and looked back up at him.
Severe hypertensions, arrhythmias. We got 5 people on anti-rejection drugs for transplants. Jesus Christ, John, what do you want me to do?
He hated himself for doing it, but now started, he couldn't stop.
I lost Mary already, Liz. Please, dear God, not Jennifer, too, not that.
He lowered his head, tears clouding his eyes. He wiped them away, struggling for control. He looked back into Liz's eyes, shamed, and yet, if need be, determined. Liz looked straight at him, and John could see that her eyes were clouded as well.
It's going to get bad, isn't it, John?
He nodded his head, unable to speak. Liz continued to gaze at him, then sighed, turned, and opened the refrigerator. She pulled out 4 vials, hesitated, then a 5th. John struggled with the horrible temptation to shove Liz aside, reach in, and scoop all of them out.
The temptation was near overpowering. He felt the touch of a hand on his shoulder and started to swing, wondering if somebody was pushing their way in. It was Michaela. She gazed at him and said nothing. Liz quickly closed the refrigerator, opened a cabinet, took out a box of 100 syringes, then bagged the vials and box up, wrapping several extra layers of plastic around the package. "Maybe I'm damning myself for doing this," Liz said quietly. "That's 5 for you. There'll be 5 for the Valenti boy and 1 each for the remaining 30 that come in here." "That's fair enough," Michaela whispered. Liz looked at her, didn't say anything, then turned away. "Stop at the cooler. There still might be some ice there. Grab up whatever candy bars are left as well. Go straight home, John. They should be kept stable at 40 degrees. Every 10-degree increase cuts the shelf life in half. So go home now. Once you run out of ice, try and find the coolest spot in the house to store them." "Thank you, Liz. God bless you." "Please leave, John. I got a lot to think about, to do today."
John nodded, still filled with a sense of shame. "You want me to stop at the police station and bring someone back?" Liz shook her head.
"I'll send Rachel into town to get some help. She rode a bike in here, so she can be there nearly as quick as you."
Liz then opened a drawer in the locked room and pointed down. Inside was a .38 special.
"It was against company policy, but my husband insisted I keep it here. You know how he is, ex-ranger and all that. I'd have used it if you hadn't showed up."
And her voice was now cold. John wondered if he had tried to shove Liz aside. Would that .38 have come out? From the look in his friend's eyes, he knew it would. "Some advice, Liz."
"Sure."
"Get out of here."
"You know I can't do that, John."
"I mean, once it starts to run short, load up what you think you'll need for you and your family, then get out. When you start running out, it could get ugly." She looked up at him and smiled, all 5'2" of her standing with shoulders back.
"Jim taught me how to use that gun," she said. "I'll see things through."
John squeezed her shoulder. "God bless you." And he walked out. The line behind the counter was growing. There were several nods of recognition. Some were silent. Apparently, everyone in line knew what had just happened with the bloody man, whom Pat had thoroughly trussed up with, of all things, a roll of duct tape. One woman saw the bag John was carrying.
"Matheson, isn't it?"
"Yes, ma'am." She looked past John to Liz.
"What did you give him back there?" "Just some syringes for his little girl, that's all, Julie." "I don't want to hear of any special treatment going on here, Liz. If so, I've been a customer of this firm for 20 years, and let me tell you, I have a list here."
John went down aisle 4. Surprisingly, there was a whole stack of 1-pound Hershey bars, and without hesitating, he scooped them all up and dumped them into the bag. The high school-aged girl behind the counter saw him do it, not sure what to say as he walked by. "Don't worry. Liz said I can take them now and pay later." The girl nodded, his action setting off an argument with a customer who had no cash and wanted cigarettes. Outside, John opened up the ice cooler. There were still a dozen 10-pound bags inside. He unlocked the car, opened the back door, and went back. Pulling out 4 bags and tossing them in, went back again and started to grab 4 more, then hesitated, looking at Michaela. He took just 2, closed the lid, tossed them in the car, and slammed the door shut. John got into the car, took a deep breath, started it up, and lit another cigarette.
"That'll kill you someday,"
Michaela said quietly. He looked over at her, unable to speak.
"You did the right thing. And so did Liz. Any parent would have done the same."
John sighed. "Remember the old movies, the old cartoons from the Second World War? All the stuff about food hoarders?"
"A bit before my time."
"Hell, I'm only 48. I remember 'em."
She didn't say anything.
Your girl has type 1 diabetes, doesn't she?
Yes.
You better get home now, like Liz said.
Michaela reached over the back seat, and he felt like an absolute bastard, for he found himself looking at her as she stretched, dress riding up to mid-thigh. She caught his eye as she pulled a bag of ice over and said nothing as she broke it open. She dumped the box of syringes out of the plastic bag and then gently laid the bag containing the vials atop the open ice.
That should do till you get home. Don't pack them inside the ice. They'll freeze, and that will ruin them. Try wrapping insulation around the ice, but keep the top open and have the vials on top. That should keep them at roughly the right temperature. Stash the remaining ice inside your freezer. That's the best insulated place for them. With some luck, the ice should last you up to a week.
I don't know how to thank you enough, John said.
Well, helping me find some food might be a good starter, she said with a smile.
I know where there's great barbecue.
Sounds wonderful.
He pulled out of the plaza and headed back towards town.
Hope you don't mind a personal question, she asked.
Go ahead.
Who's Mary?
My wife.
How long ago?
Breast cancer, 4 years back.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, he lied. She left me 2 beautiful girls.
I could see that last night. I kind of suspected your younger was diabetic. In my business, you can spot it. That's why it didn't bother me too much when you took off like you did. Stress is bad for her situation.
I know. Again, I'm sorry about running out on you like that. She smiled.
Oh, there was a truck driver there, a regular white knight. He finally beat the crap out of the drunk, then walked us ladies down to the motel.
She hesitated.
You kind of surprised me, the way you took that man out in the drugstore.
You figured I was running out at first, didn't you?
Well, to be honest, yeah, I did.
I didn't, though. She chuckled softly.
You sure as hell didn't. Bit underhanded, maybe, but you settled it.
If you must fight, fight to win, John said quietly.
You know you got a cut hand, don't you?
He looked at his right hand, and for the first time the pain registered. Part of the broken bottle had laid a deep slice into his right forefinger, clear down to the crease with his thumb. Damn, it suddenly hurt like hell.
Pull over. Let me look at it.
He drifted to the side of the road and came to a stop. She took his hand and gently spread the wound open. Now it really hurt.
You'll need stitches, 10 to 12 from the looks of it.
As she examined it, blood dripped onto her suit. Be careful, your suit, he said. She ignored him.
I don't have anything sterile on me. You should stop at a doctor's.
Later. I want to get the medicine home first. Besides, the dock is most likely swamped right now. As he spoke, he nodded towards the road. Maury Hurt's World War II Jeep was coming down off the exit ramp of the interstate. 4 people piled in, one a child with shoulders hunched over, pale-faced, gasping. Lying across the back of the Jeep was an elderly woman, who John could see was already dead.
We don't realize just how dependent we are, Michaela sighed,
watching as the Jeep weaved around some stalled cars to head into town.
I'd hate to be in my hospital right now. If the generators didn't kick on, everyone in ICU or under surgery is most likely dead. I watched one poor fool killing himself last night. Had a Beamer like mine. The drunks kind of scared him, and he insisted on pushing the car as if somebody was actually going to steal it. Damn fool. Someone told me later that he collapsed. People are crazy, and this is bringing it out big time.
She let go of his hand.
If you can find something, I'll bandage it up, but you should get that medicine home.
He wondered if she was inviting herself over, and at that moment he honestly didn't know how to react. He started the car back up and drove into town, turning onto State Street. More and more people were crowding in around the town hall complex. Poor Tom had a cordon of his officers out. A large, hand-lettered sign was posted at the main intersection. "Emergency Medical," pointing towards the firehouse next to the town hall.
"Maybe I should go over there and help,"
she said. "First get some food," John replied. He had already turned onto State Street, and seconds later the elementary school was in view.
"Why not go back there and get some stitches?"
"My mother-in-law can handle it," he finally said.
"Sure."
And there wasn't any reaction in her voice one way or the other. "Just make sure you dose it well with an antibiotic. If things are as bad as I heard you say to Liz, you can't risk any kind of infection." "Yes, ma'am."
"Come on, it's Michaela,"
he smiled.
"Right."
He pulled up onto the lawn of the elementary school. Pete was still at his grill. The line was just about gone. John got out of the car and walked up. Michaela followed.
"Hey, Pete, busy today?"
"You got that straight, Professor. Figure the stuff is gonna rot. Health inspector won't let me use the meat anyhow, going this long with no refrigeration, so what the hell? Might as well put on a damn good barbecue."
John smiled. He genuinely liked this guy. Pork barbecue was something John had never really cared for, especially with the spices Pete threw in, but still, he'd eat there occasionally, just to hang out and chat.
"Professor?" Michaela asked.
"Regular brain there," Pete said. "Professor at the college here, army colonel, too. They were even going to give him a star and make him a general, but he quit."
Pete's voice trailed off. Naturally, everyone in town, of course, knew why John retired early, but Pete was leading into private matters, and a bit embarrassed, he stopped.
"All right, Pete," John said with a smile, breaking the nervous pause. "This lady's a good friend, so give a double of anything she wants, okay?"
John started to extend his hand to shake hers, and she smiled.
"Get it bandaged, John. Then we'll shake."
"Sure."
He started to walk back to the car, hesitated, and looked back. She was looking at him, and he motioned her to come over.
"Look, I guess you're staying at the Holiday Inn?"
"I guess so."
"You know how to get back there?"
"Easy enough. Turn left at the light and cross the tracks."
"Well, look, I don't want you to take this wrong. You need anything, you walk up this road just about a mile. Turn right on Ridgecrest Drive. I'm number 18.
"Okay, John. Maybe I will sometime."
"Thanks for your advice with the medicine. I better get it home."
"John?"
"Yeah?"
"You were checking me out when I was leaning over the seat, weren't you?"
He found himself blushing.
"It's okay. After a high-stress situation, men usually think that way. I wasn't insulted. I just want you to know it's normal. It might bother you later, you know, given you should be worried about your girl, memories of your wife, and such."
Now she blushed slightly.
"That came out awkward. Get home now. I'll be okay."
"Thanks, Michaela."
He got into the car and drove off, carefully balancing the bag of ice with one hand, the vials of medication on top. As he turned the engine off, he was delighted to see Jennifer and Pat up in the field tossing the frisbee back and forth. Ginger gave him a quick look, but then went back to chasing the frisbee, but old Zack came down, tail wagging and greeting. Elizabeth was out by the pool, dressed in shorts and t-shirt, sunning herself, Ben sitting beside her, acting as if he was reading a book. The shotgun was leaning against the wall by Ben's side. He stood up at the sight of John and came up to the car.
"Could you help me get the ice in, Ben?
There's some cartons of smokes in there as well."
"Sure, sir."
Still balancing the one bag with the vials on top, John headed into the house. Jen was in the living room, just standing quietly looking out the window, turning and smiling as he came in. She didn't need to be told what he was doing when she saw the CVS bag.
"Get the basement door for me, will you, Jen?"
She opened it. He was suddenly paranoid that somehow he might drop the precious load, and he clutched the bag of ice with one hand to his chest, the other on top of the vials, holding them in place. Going down to the basement,
He looked around for a moment and spotted an old styrofoam cooler. He laid the bag of ice in and placed it inside the shower stall, and then carefully laid the vials on top. He put the lid on, but left it cracked open, and then with a pocket knife popped a small hole in the bottom of the foam cooler to let the melted water drain off. It was getting to be a bit messy, blood dripping from his hand.
"How much medication did you get for?" Ben asked.
John looked back and saw the young man looking at him intently.
5 vials.
5 months, not counting what's in the fridge? It caught John by surprise.
Yes, something like that.
I see, Ben said quietly. John stood up.
Look, Ben, I'm not going to lie to you. The situation might be bad. I suspect we've been hit by a weapon that has shut down the electrical grid nationwide. That means it might be months before we get power back again.
He took it in, nodding his head, saying nothing.
But not a word of this to Elizabeth or Jennifer, understood? Let me tell them in my own way.
Jennifer. And again his throat tightened. She was one smart kid, very smart, and when she learned that the power would be off for a very long time, she just might figure out that the clock was ticking for her. He looked back into Ben's eyes, saying nothing.
"Yes, sir," Ben whispered.
"Fine, then."
"You're bleeding, sir."
"An accident, nothing serious." He went back up the stairs and sat down at the dining room table. Jen was already waiting with the first aid kit.
"What happened?"
He looked up. Ben was standing by the door out to the deck. "Everything's okay, Ben, but remember, I don't want those girls worrying about things. Given the way things are, I'm expecting you to be a man and keep a sharp watch on them."
"Anything you say, sir."
And he left the room.
"You know, John, he really is a nice boy. By the way, while you were gone, we ran out of water."
"Already?"
"Poor Jennifer. She used the toilet and, well, it didn't flush, and she was really embarrassed. Ben got a bucket, hauled the water in from the pool, flushed it, then filled the tank up again. He's a good kid."
John laid his hand on the table and she peered at it.
"You should have stopped to get stitches."
"No time. I wanted to get the medication home."
"I'll butterfly bandage it for now," and she set to work. "You can have Kella look at it later. Now what happened to you, and fill me in on all the news."
He told her just about everything, except for Michaela, and, of course, the Mustang. Chapter 4 Day 4 The sound of the helicopter, a Black Hawk, after silence for so long, was startling. It came in hot, about 500 feet up, skimming over the interstate pass, leveling out. He felt an emotional surge at the sight of it, the black star on its side. It roared past his house, which was high enough off the valley floor that he could almost see into the pilot's side window. Elizabeth was jumping up and down, shrieking, waving.
"We're saved!" Elizabeth shouted gleefully. "We're saved!"
She sounded like a shipwrecked sailor on a desert island. John found himself waving as well, and the helicopter thundered on, heading due west, growing smaller, the sound receding, then disappearing, the silence all engulfing again. The elation disappeared into a sense of overwhelming depression. Somehow, the sight of that lone bird was now symbolic of so much, and maybe it was a portent that within a few more minutes the electricity would come back on. He stood for several minutes, shading his eyes, gazing westward, and everything was as it had been. Dejected, Elizabeth walked over to the side of the swimming pool and sat down, dipping her feet in. Ben came over and splashed her. The water was still cold. Without the pump, there was no circulation into the solar heating panels. The water was still clear, though.
John was dosing it heavily with chlorine, since it was, for now, their drinking and bathing water. The kids swimming in it would at least keep the water stirred up. Jen was already waiting in the car. Ben waved. John casually pointed to where the shotgun was, and Ben nodded in reply. Jennifer was down today with her friend Pat, joining a couple of other girls who were going to play Monopoly for the afternoon. Starting the Edsel, John rolled down the driveway, out onto Route 70, turned east, and drove the short distance up to Miller's nursing home, where Tyler was. Jen had gone up to check on him the day after the outage, and said that though it was chaotic, Tyler was doing okay. She was silent now, tense, as they drove. None of them had left home yesterday, except for one brief foray by John. He had laid out a long series of tasks. All the meat still in the freezer downstairs was pulled out and cooked thoroughly, with everyone eating as much as they could before wrapping the rest in plastic and storing it. He wasn't sure if it would help or not, but what salt they had was liberally sprinkled on the meat. Next came a privy pit dug at the edge of Connie's orchard, with a privacy screen made out of a tent. The girls had argued that the toilets inside were just fine, and there had been a rather delicate discussion about what the privy could be used for and what the toilets inside would be used for.
"Oh, for that, just do it like Zach does," Jennifer replied with a grin. "Against a tree."
It took a bit of explaining as to the health hazard of that suggestion, then a bit of retrofitting around the house. The waterbed was already getting chilly without a heater, so extra blankets were dragged up from the basement to lay down as a covering, some old decorative candles pulled out, old clothes that might be cut into strips for toilet paper, and to his surprise an old chainsaw, not used in years, actually started up after Ben fiddled around with it for a while. He then made one quick run down to the market on the east side of town, the old Food Lion, hoping to stock up on some goods, canned food, toilet paper. But it had already been picked over clean. In fact, it looked more as if it had been looted. He could have kicked himself for not having seen to this shopping before the panicked rush. One of the managers was still inside the darkened store, just sitting, reading a magazine, when John came in.
"Hell of a show here last night, Professor," he announced. "Never thought I'd see friends and neighbors act like they did. People running around, loading up baskets to overflowing. I kept trying to say no cash, no sale. And, well, they just started pushing by me, and that set it off. Place was pretty well cleaned out before the cops finally showed up." He shrugged.
"Mind if I look around?" John asked.
"Sure. Be my guest, sir."
There was not a basket to be found, so he just simply wandered up and down the aisles. A half dozen or so were in the store, doing as he did. One elderly couple was prowling through the frozen food freezers, pulling out smashed and soggy boxes of vegetables and waffles, stuffing them into a plastic trash bag. All the canned goods were picked clean, of course. Underfoot were smashed bottles, busted cans, bits of meat, chicken, and seafood. The floor was slippery, and began to smell in the heat. Hundreds of flies were already buzzing about. Over in the bakery goods, he found a busted 20-pound bag of flour kicked to one side on the floor, and immediately grabbed it. In the pet foods was a 25-pound bag of dry dog food torn open, maybe 15 to 20 pounds still inside, which he grabbed as well. Near the door, he saw a 10-pound bag of rock salt left over from winter, and instantly snatched it. There was not much else, and he headed for the door. He looked at the manager.
"Just take it, Doc. It's okay."
John paused, curious.
"Why are you here, Ernie?"
He motioned to the darkened store. The elderly couple slowly dragged the trash bag full of defrosted food. The air around him was thick with the rising scent of decay. Ernie looked at him, slowly shaking his head.
"Don't know, Doc. Habit, I guess. No family. Dolores and the kids left me last year. Just habit, I guess."
John nodded his thanks and tossed the loot into the back seat of the car. Backing up to the dollar store, he went in and found much the same chaos, this store torn apart with no one inside.
"Who's in there?"
Turning,